Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Michelle Bichelia, wine director at Blue Hill in New York City. We'll talk about what to drink with farm-to-table food. We'll talk about sustainable food and wine and a lot more. We'll also taste an Italian white for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right, Michelle Bichelia worked her way up through the New York restaurant scene and also got her hands dirty working the harvest in Burgundy and Piedmont. She now oversees the wine program at one of the true farm-to-table restaurants in the U.S. at Dan Barber's award-winning Blue Hill in New York City, down in Greenwich Village. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on here.
Yeah.
I want you to give our audience a little context and tell us about your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are now, which is the wine director at Blue Hill. Now, you don't have to tell me what color pajamas you wore and you had a mean aunt.
Remember that anyway.
Yeah.
So. Wine kind of started into my life later than I think most people possibly in the industry. I didn't really grow up with wine. I grew up just outside of Atlantic City in South Jersey. My parents drank like boxed wine and Coors Light, and that was that. So I never really had been introduced to any sort of fine wine until later, till probably late college and then after college. So I went to college in Philly. I was pre-med, early acceptance into medical school.
So you got in.
And then, yeah.
Oh, boy. And your parents must be pissed.
They're not anymore.
Not anymore.
Time of, okay. For sure. Right before I was about to enter my first year, I kind of took a step back and said, I don't really know. I'm not 100,000% into this. I think I'm going to take some time off and travel a little bit. So I had double majored in Spanish along with the pre-med major and decided to go to South America and travel around. Came back and was like, I don't really think I'm gonna stick with med school. I'm going to take maybe a year off and figure it out. My sister was living in New York at the time.
So just as a bookend, what year was this?
2008.
Eight. Okay. So we're working from eight up.
Eight go up. Ahead. Yeah. So came to New York and walked into like an open call interview for waiters at Pastis. And got hired and literally like put on a uniform and started working like that hour. I think if I remember correctly, they were that desperate. So their wine program there at the time was run by Chris Goodhart, who was an incredible wine director, very humble, very knowledgeable, but really made wine very approachable. And he would do these really incredible staff wine tastings where it would open up bottles that were like $1,000, $2,000 on the wine list.
That was on the list of Pastis?
Yeah, yeah. Old Chav, Old Burgundy, Old Lois, things like that. And I was like, whoa.
And did he explain sort of the heaviness of this is not an ordinary bottle of wine?
Definitely. Okay. So you stepped up. You took kind of the basic intro courses with him as a waiter there. You're required to. And then he had kind of the voluntary ones for things like that, believe it or not.
Right.
And they weren't always full, which is crazy. But after tasting those old wines, I was kind of taken aback, like, whoa, I can't believe that this beverage exists, that things can taste like this, things can age like this. I want to learn about why this is happening, how this is happening, and what's happening.
Wow.
So I approached him and said, hey, can I kind of work with you, just taste with you, figure out kind of what you're doing? And he was like, absolutely, let's do it. So it kind of became his cellar rat, tasted with him. And then, yeah, after that I said, you know, I really want to go and work in France and see what this is about. And he was like, yeah, you should go to Burgundy. Don't go anywhere else but Burgundy. And I said, okay. So I emailed anyone I'd ever met in that past kind of like 6 months
to
I was working with
harvest.
Him. Yeah. And almost everybody said no. And then one guy said yes. And it was the guy who I ended up working for. His name is Blair Pethel. He's an American guy. And his winery is called Domaine du Blair. And he's in Savigny-le-Bon.
So he at some point moved there.
Yeah, he moved. He had moved there maybe about 10 years before. He was a political journalist in D.C.
Wow.
Wanted to change his life.
So instead of going to Napa, he went to Burgundy.
He went to Burgundy and became respected in Burgundy, like worked for a lot of the people around. And, you know, he was very liked in Burgundy, which I think is probably pretty hard to do
coming from
the outside. So I worked with him 2009 and 2010.
Wasn't
two harvests in a row.
A great vintage?
They were both great and
right.
very different. So 2009, 2010 in Burgundy. It was amazing to see the drastic difference in fruit, but also in kind of like what you have to do.
You really
for wine, like,
got to firsthand see and experience.
I mean, in 2009, I remember we made a rosé for like the house wine out of Premier Cru Volnay for us to just drink, you know?
Nice.
And in 2010, that definitely didn't happen. We were still drinking the previous year's rosé. That's how much was left over. So I came back from Burgundy in 2010.
Now, when you were there, you did everything?
Everything.
Anything you I'm sure you volunteered everything.
Everything, yeah. I mean, I wanted to see every aspect and every side. I went a little bit early and stayed a little bit later
right.
than harvest. So I was there for more than just like a month. I think I was there for a total of 3 months each year.
Did you enjoy it or
I loved it
became,
it.
You know, tough?
Not at all. I loved it.
You loved it.
I loved every part about it. And I loved how much wine we got to taste and how much you got to learn by being in that place and kind of seeing Burgundy firsthand. It's like nothing else in the world. So I came back to New York and said, okay, I think I'm going to keep wine in my life is what I want to do. I want to make this my career. But I didn't really know that much about service. So I was like, okay, I want to work at a Michelin 3-star restaurant. I want to work at Danielle. So I applied to Danielle and they were like, you don't have any wine experience, so you'll be a back waiter. Here's a polishing rag, polish glasses for 10 hours a day. And I was like, okay. So I did that for a
was
few months.
Was that actually at Danielle or one of the other restaurants?
That was at Danielle.
It was.
At Restaurant Danielle. So I got to meet the wine team there, kind of made sure I like befriended them all a little bit, you know, to kind of get my name in the game.
Are they gracious? Are they
They were extremely
insular?
Gracious.
They took you in if you showed an interest?
Extremely.
Okay.
Yeah, extremely. And, you know, the general manager there really helped me too because he was like very excited about my enthusiasm. So that worked well. And then Beloud Sud opened, and then I got offered to open Beloud Sud as an opening sommelier. So then that's how I got kind of my foot in the door and then worked there for a few years.
Was Bar Beloud there,
mm-hmm.
too?
Yeah. Yep. So were
you doing both?
I was doing both.
Right.
I was doing both, kind of back and forth. But I worked at Beloud Sud with Michael Madrigal and Levy Dalton. So it was the three of us. So it was pretty like...
Levy left first.
And
then
yeah.
Michael hung on for years.
Yeah, Michael hung on for a
right.
longer time because he went over from Bar Beloud. So
right.
I got to work with incredible people, taste incredible wines, and you know, really kind of develop my palate and I think like my style as far as wine. And then I left there and went to Italy for a summer and worked in the vineyard. So it wasn't harvest, it was like the vineyard work of the summer. So it was pretty
like trimming,
yeah, it
canopies
was
canopies
exactly
whatever, all that stuff.
But again, being there firsthand, seeing those vineyards of Barolo and kind of driving through Serra Lunga, it's like, oh, okay, everything clicks and makes sense. And then I came back to New
Why
York.
Why did you pick Piedmont? Did you have an affinity for Barolo? Or
big time,
just...
yeah. I think any Burgundy lover, if you're going to go anywhere in Italy, it's going to be
right.
Piedmont, right?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
That's what I hope you were
going to
say.
Yeah, it was a natural kind of transition over there. And then,
so this was as you were working at Bar Beloud?
I left.
You left, okay.
I left there, yeah. I left.
So you said, let me do another trip abroad.
Yeah, yeah. I figured, let me do it now, get it out of the way. You know, continue to learn, and Burgundy was such an eye-opening and mesmerizing experience. I wanted to do kind of the same thing in Italy.
Right.
Also kind of practice the language a little bit. So, yeah, it was incredible. And then I came back in the fall, I think it was 2011, maybe later? No.
No, it was 11.
Yeah, 11.
You started at Blue Hill in 12.
Right. came back. So no, it must have been 12 because I started Blue Hill as soon as I came back.
Right.
I came back and actually one of the first managers of Blue Hill used to be the general manager of Bluetsud. So he called me and said, I heard you're back. Blue Hill's looking for a wine director. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely.
Wine director, not even a somm.
There was only one wine person
and
that's
they're
it.
The director. Okay.
And that's it. So,
good break.
Yeah.
So you took the job there in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew what you were getting into? I mean, interesting, different chef, restaurant, menu?
Yes and no. I mean, part of the interview process there is going up to Stone Barns, having a dinner up there, meeting the entire team. It's a very tight family. So when you go up there and you interview with like 20 people. Like all of the chefs come and talk to you. All of the managers of both restaurants talk to you. The president, the two owners, the sous chef, everybody. Just to kind of like get a feel for, does it feel right? Very much about gut feeling.
Did it go well in your mind?
Yeah.
Did it feel well on your end?
Yeah, it felt great.
I didn't feel like these guys don't get me or it was...
No,
it
they
worked.
Were... Yeah, they all kind of had a genuine interest in what I was saying and it felt pretty good when I was chatting with them all pretty much.
How long was the process? Few weeks?
Well,
few
it was... I think it's something that normally would take a few weeks, but they were pretty... last minute
they
as far
move.
As they
Good
had to move
you.
Fast. So, yeah, I just kind of went for it
good
hard.
For you.
Yeah, it was good.
So now is that, I wouldn't say the job of your dreams, but that's what you wanted to be doing at that point, right?
Definitely. I think as far as wine, if you're interested in food, wine, and agriculture, it's got to be the best job in New York.
How much did you know about Blue Hill? I mean, you knew they had that whole...
Yeah.
Dan Barber was leading that whole drive.
Yeah, I knew that he was, you know, on the forefront as far as the farm to table movement. I didn't quite realize how in depth he was and how involved he was, way more beyond just farm to table, you know.
Right.
But I learned a lot in my first year.
So I want to, a little later in the interview,
mm-hmm.
we'll come back and,
okay.
you know, we'll cover Blue Hill thoroughly. But I mm-hmm. want to run through a few things with you before
sure.
we get to that. I've had a lot of women somms on the show.
Okay.
And sometimes I ask women somms if now in the industry you're more accepted and the path is easier. Because I had Pascaline LePeltier. Mm-hmm. She said in Europe it was terrible.
Sure.
She got here, it was better. And New York's better than most places. But is there still anything going on or you don't feel it as far as being a woman sommelier?
I don't feel it that often. There's definitely sometimes like the boys' clubs who just like want to hang out and drink a ton of wine and
they don't really
like want women around, you know. I don't know, maybe like their girlfriends get jealous if there's like a woman around there drinking wine. Who knows what it is, but I don't really care. You know, I love what I do, and I have a ton of friends, both male and female, throughout the industry, throughout the business, and I think everyone respects each other and everyone supports each other, and that's all that you really need.
So it's, I think in New York, it's less of an issue.
I think it is.
I mean, obviously, they came after you for the job, and the process happened quickly, and,
yeah.
you know, it's the best person. Forget about guy, woman, or all
that. I think so. I think most people nowadays think like that. You occasionally get, you know, you're like... old school business guy in the restaurant who's like, you're the sommelier.
Well, I was going to ask you that. So that's the industry, the
yeah.
customer.
Yeah. And you're just like, yeah, I am. What do you want to know? And then, you know, you just get them to trust you within
do
that 1 second.
Do they ever persist?
No, I've never had them persist. Never.
I think the vibe of the restaurant, too, is a little mellower.
Definitely.
You know, there are some other restaurants that are a lot stiff, more stiff. What about, do you feel the same way with women in winemaking? I mean, have women made strides in winemaking? Do you think it's still difficult?
I think they have. I mean, I think, like, the Munir Asia Borg sisters, like, everyone respects and loves them.
Are they running the winery
Yeah, the three of them are
now?
Running the winery. You know,
and it's an old winery, but
mm-hmm.
same thing with Antonori in a way, right? The daughters?
Yeah, yeah. Gaia in Italy,
the daughter,
she's representing the winery. Maggie Harrison from Antica Terra in Willamette Valley, she's doing incredible things and very well respected. I think, yeah, they're kind of in the playing field and it's pretty leveling out pretty nicely.
So I guess I wouldn't say it's a turning point, but the issues are not, you know, major anymore. Hopefully it's a little behind us. The percentages are still low. But I think...
But it's rising.
Yeah.
And
I think you... inspire other women.
I hope so.
Other women in the business.
I hope so, because it's, you know, you just figure out what you want to do and then just do it, no matter who or what you are.
Right.
You
know? So. Right. It's nice to hear that.
Yeah.
Because every now and then somebody really bitches pretty hard about it. But
nah,
that's,
I feel good.
That's becoming less and less. All right, I want to ask you some stuff about wine. As summer approaches, I've noticed something more recently than in the past. Canned wine spritzers.
I was just talking about
wine.
It yesterday.
What's going on? And it's there's a whole separate issue of sommeliers making wine. I had Patrick Capiello on. He came in with
40 ounce. Sure.
But what's going on with wine spritzers and, you know, even some higher quality canned wine? What's your take
on
that?
I think it's like just going back to simplicity, like keeping it easy, keeping it fresh, something that's just like pop and pour. You know, I think with the inaccessibility of some of the higher-end wines these days, it's kind of nice to go back to, like, the 40-ounce Muscadet
right.
or, yeah, I mean, I saw
but
someone else.
But the quality on that is good.
Yeah, it's
pretty
good.
You know, he's sourcing, and I guess the spritzer thing, you're sitting on a beach, you want to get a little buzz, you're not going to bring a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty delicious.
Easy to carry around.
Not the type of stuff you serve in the restaurant.
No,
right?
I don't have any of that stuff in the restaurant. I mean, maybe at, like, I don't know, a simple bistro place. Why not? You can go to Chelsea Market. And,
I could see it, you know, in a lot of places.
Go to Lobster Place and get a glass of that 40-ounce Muscadet.
Now, have you tasted some of this stuff?
Yeah. I've had the Ramona Spritz.
Which
I've had
Jordan's Salcedo.
And it's delicious. It's delicious, yeah.
Who knew?
It's like, easy, like, throwback patio pounder. It's good.
Great.
Yeah.
All right, tell me about these. So that's sort of a trend.
Yeah, it is.
You know, that didn't happen years ago. It's happening now. We'll see next year, the year after, if there's 10 more guys or levels.
It's fun. It's like a little hipstery, but I dig it. If it's delicious, why not?
I think it has traction because the people behind it are passionate about it.
Yeah, and respected people.
And they get out there.
Yeah.
And they're respected.
Yeah.
Tell me about any other trends or happenings in wine or regions. You know, even if you look at the 4 years you've been at Blue Hill, I'm sure the list has shifted. Things have changed. You've paid attention. I mean, what's at the top of the list?
I mean, I think just things for me, wines that stand out for me a little bit more nowadays are wines that are a little bit more rare, harder to find.
Give me an
but still
example.
Very approachable. I don't
Does
know,
that so, mean expensive?
No, or? Approachable and inexpensive.
So what?
Good value. So, like, for example, you know, we have a wine on the wine list from Crete, but it's got age on it. It's 1999 vintage.
Crete is an island of Greece?
Yes.
So it's a Greek wine.
Greek wine.
Somebody forget about it, or they intentionally age it?
No, they intentionally age it. And it's a
white or a red?
They make both. I like the red. It's an indigenous grape varietal to that region called Liatico, but the winemaker did his homework and worked at places. I think he worked at Chateau Margaux in Bordeaux for a little bit. He worked at, I want to say, like Scavino in Barolo, and then came back to his homeland of Crete and decided to make this wine had ageability.
Let's drop a little knowledge. The name of the wine is
Domaine Economou.
Spell.
Economou.
And that's from the island of Crete.
Island of Crete.
And they make a white and a red.
Yep.
Forget the grape.
Yeah.
And you can find that wine with some age on the bottle.
Yep.
And what are we talking if you had to do your wholesale to retail ballpark?
Probably like $60.
And it's a total, nobody's drinking this, totally interesting.
Totally interesting, and it tastes like old Nebbiolo.
Really?
Yeah.
It has that characteristic.
That's how I sell it in the restaurant, and I've never had an issue.
Because I'm the type of guy who walks in and says, give me the funkiest, most reasonable thing you have. I get Canary Island wines
and
stuff like that. I mean, I would love to drink something.
But people
like
branching
that.
Out, I think it makes sense because you can still find value in those wines, and they're great, and they're, if from a great producer, generally very true to terroir, and that's what you want in a wine, right?
So. Give me another trend or wine or an area that you like.
Yeah, I mean,
region. Doesn't have to be a trend.
Sure. I mean, well, if we go back to trends, I mean, natural wine trend, right? That's a big trend.
I mean, the Raw Wine Fair was here in Brooklyn last fall.
And it's
so it's landed.
Yeah. It's exciting to see it cleaning up a little bit, I think. I think when it kind of first landed, maybe, what is this, probably like 8 years ago?
Yeah, eight to ten.
A lot of the wine was like undrinkable to me, like too stinky, too funky, too cider-like. I, you know, worked in Burgundy and came from
Burgundy. What happened? Did better guys come and push those guys aside, or those guys got better at making it?
I think both. I think a lot of the guys who were making those wine did a little bit more homework and started cleaning up their wineries a little bit more. But I also think the people who maybe are importing or distributing kind of figured out how to cherry pick a little bit more. So the ones that are in the market are a little bit better, a little bit cleaner. And it's great for that style of wine.
Right.
Because it's starting to make a little bit more sense. Before, it was pretty confusing, I think, for a general consumer. It's like, this isn't what I'm used to.
It's still...
Yeah, but it's getting
confusing,
better.
Confusing, and it hasn't permeated the mass market yet.
Yeah.
There are restaurants and bars, you know, that are committed to it.
Yeah.
When we talk about Blue Hill, we'll get into it more.
Okay.
But is that an important thing for Blue Hill to have a strong position?
Of natural wine?
In natural, organic, biodynamic?
I mean, it's just wine from farmers is
right.
really the most important thing. And generally, that falls in the same category. But
right.
first and foremost... farmer with a story about why they're planting this grape or what they're doing.
And you're so it's definitely artisanal and farmer driven. Your interpretation mm-hmm. of not just natural but organic, but mm-hmm. what if you said to somebody, basically, here's the overview of what this type of wine is, how do you describe it?
For organic or biodynamic?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, wine where it's just it's letting the grape speak for itself in the region that it comes from with nothing added to it.
So in the winemaking, there's no intervention.
Pretty much, no. I mean, I'm not afraid of a little bit of sulfur. I think I think some wines need a little bit of sulfur. If it smells like a glass full of sulfur, it's probably not going to be great,
right.
you know, and I'm probably not going to buy that. But I want the wine to be clean and pure, no matter where it's from or how it's made.
And clean and pure is at the grape level on the farm?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, if it's... reductive when you're first making the wine, there are ways to, you know, like open top ferment, get it out of there. So I think there are ways to
manipulation
do that,
that's
but
not
natural.
Intervention.
Exactly.
Right. So that's why there's so many different styles and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's here to stay. I'm not sure, like I said, that it's hit a lot of restaurant lists.
Yeah.
Patrick Capiello was talking about when he was a gilt, somebody turned him onto it and he mm-hmm. fell in love and he said, there's no way I'm selling this stuff.
It's hard.
These guys are coming here to drink, you know, Bordeaux and cold Cali's and, you know, Tuscan wines. Yeah. And
I mean, if we have those wines on our wine list and they're like too funky or too cloudy or, you know, any of those things that might be off-putting for a guest, like... and I'm not there, it's like written on the cov sheet, like funky, let guests know, cloudy.
But you're screening that too. I mean, your taste, you'll catch that before it hits the table. This is too funky.
Yeah,
this is
totally,
too. This ain't going to play well
on
the
floor. If someone orders something like that, I usually go over and say, I'm not warning you, but I'm kind of warning you.
Right.
This is what it's like. So if you don't want it, tell me now.
If they're up for it.
Yeah. And then, sometimes they are. Sometimes they're like, no way. Give me, you know, Shasani Mamershe. I don't want Jura White. Something like that. Yeah.
As a sommelier, you've participated in some fun stuff.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about a few things because it's sort of behind the scene. But, you know, it's a part of what you do. Wine and Spirits magazine.
Yeah.
Is that Josh Green?
Yeah,
that's
Josh. Yeah.
He does an event every year, and it's not that old. It's called Wine and Spirit Magazine Somm Scavenger Hunt.
Uh-huh.
And I think you participated at the beginning.
So it's
and
it's
I think
just,
you won it.
Yeah.
But what is it? It's an industry thing.
It is. So what they do is they pick a region or an area. So the first year it was the United States, so a very large region. And then the second year it was Australia. And then they send five or six groups of three sommeliers. Three teams of sommeliers to specific regions.
Selected by Wine and Spirits?
They select the region, and we choose what we want.
And he can go.
Exactly. They select a captain. The captain chooses the region. And then you go to that region. You pick a grape varietal that you think represents that region well. You choose six wines of that same grape varietal by tasting around. Then you bring those six wines back, and then you have kind of a taste-off, essentially, where you give a presentation on those six wines. It has to tell the story of why you chose those wines and why you think it represents
that
region.
So let's put some context into it. The first year you did U.S.,
first year we
I would
did
assume
US.
It was out west.
It was all over.
It was.
There was Finger Lakes Riesling. There was Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. There was Napa Valley Cabernet, which is what we had, my team had. There was, I think, Sonoma Pinot Noir as well. Yeah, and maybe just like Washington State Cabernet.
So one team was all Finger Lakes Riesling.
Yep.
One team was all Napa.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your job was to go out and give the most interesting, best representation to compete?
Exactly.
So what's the game plan? I mean, what do you do when you get out there?
I mean, our game plan was to just taste like crazy, taste old school, taste new school, and talk to everyone about what they like. So we would go to winemakers like Steve Mathiason in Napa and say, hey, what do you like? And he would say, here, 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 here. And we'd just add them onto our list of people to visit, call them up and try to go visit them. So I remember Steve Mathiason said, hey, you got to go to these guys at Smith Madrone. We went to Smith Madrone, and
which is an older winery. Been
around since the 70s.
It's not like dirty and rowdy or something.
Not even close. Yeah. They have this amazing vineyard right on Spring Mountain, make like beautiful rustic style, old school Napa Cab. And it's, you know, probably like $60 retail as opposed to some of these other ones. So the wines were phenomenal. So we kind of just discovered that and then made sure we represented some of the different regions of Napa, so the different AVAs within it, and then different styles too. So maybe like new, young, you know, like Arnold Roberts Cabernet or something like that, and then, you know, going against like Diamond Creek Cabernet. So two contrasting styles and everything in between.
So now you have
that tells the story.
You have your six wines.
Yep.
The other teams have their six wines.
Yep.
There's a panel of judges.
There's a big panel of judges, wine writers, master somms, all those kinds of winemakers.
And they're looking for what? Creativity, diversity, quality, all of that?
All of those things. And then, yeah, quality of the
your
wines.
Your presentation.
Yeah. The presentation, quality of the wines. If the story makes sense, like do these wines make sense in the story? Like, why did you choose these wines? And then, yeah, just kind of like the overall presentation skills, I think, as well. But we always chose a much more creative style of presentation. So,
more,
yeah, a little
more
bit.
More what?
I don't know. Like, the
more
first.
More animated?
Definitely or? More animated. You know, the first year, everyone else did a PowerPoint presentation. And we knew that was going to happen. We said, everyone's going to do a PowerPoint presentation.
Boring, right?
And I said, and probably hand out rocks.
Unless
and like
there's pictures of naked people or something.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to be fun,
no.
Right?
So we went up with just kind of an easel and some markers. And we had, like, drawn a few things on the easel. But as we each told the story of the wine. By the way, the presentation is, like, 6 minutes long. So it's fast. Like
you have to get
like
everything in.
45 seconds per wine. So we did almost like a draw as you go type of thing,
right.
And they were like kind of funny and edgy and catchy and, you know,
caught
silly
everyone.
But
so you
it
won
kept
the first year
attention. We won the first year.
You won the second year.
We won the second year
with Australian wines.
With Australian wine.
And have you done it since?
We just did it again, and we did Ontario Pinot Noir.
Now same team 3 years in a row.
Yeah, same team 3 years in a row. Yeah.
Were other returning teams same teams, or are they mix up a little?
No, we were the only returning team 2 years ago, and then last year they brought back another returning team. So it was, yeah.
What happened with the Ontario wines?
Well, we didn't win, but...
Do you think, no knock to Ontario wines, but do you think it had something to do with the wines?
I think... if you compare, like, Ontario Pinot Noir to, say, like, the juicy, luscious Sonoma Pinot Noir... That Sonoma Pinot Noir is pretty delicious in the glass.
So taste is a big,
big
decider,
yeah.
Too. Okay.
Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? And Ontario wine's hard and firm and it's
good, though?
Great. Yeah.
It's just in the context of other wines. Because, you know, I've had Raj Parr on and other guys. And Jasmine Hirsch,
yeah.
Everybody's making a more restrained wine.
Totally, yeah.
You know, so you have the restrained wine. I guess you have this Canadian wine. You have, like, the big stuff and all of that.
Yeah, and everything in between.
But you know what? A noble effort to support. I know Michael Madrigal is a big Canadian
fan. Well, he was on my team.
Right.
So
I knew that.
We went together.
All right. So that's the Somme scavenger hunt, which is a fun industry thing. And then we've had Daniel Jonas on, who pretty much founded La Paulette.
Yeah.
And that is pretty much a Burgundy orgy.
Big time.
And also the Fête du Champagne, which is a champagne orgy.
Yeah.
And basically, tell people what you do. You pay to get tickets to the most amazing access of events, tastings, verticals. But Daniel brings in literally dozens of sommeliers.
Yeah, there's a lot of us.
To work for free?
Work for free.
But, sometimes. And why do you,
why
do you do it?
Because you get to taste some of the best wines you'll ever get to taste in your life, especially that grand tasting dinner.
It's an aggregation of stuff you own.
You know, it's epic wines from epic wineries, from epic vintages that were stored properly and beautiful, especially, you know, so the way it works is there's this grand gala dinner. So, you know, people pay Daniel Boulud cooks, and he brings in all sorts of chefs. Michel Trogot cooks sometimes. You know, mostly old school French chefs, they all do a course, and then people pay to go to this dinner where these amazing chefs cook, and then they all bring their own wine.
Is any wine brought in besides what they bring in, or it's all about...
They bring in wine. Also, Daniel always kind of gives everyone a glass of generally Meursault, because this is kind of a payback to the La Palais de Meursault, which is where this originated. So he's bringing the tradition over here. So he'll usually get a giant bottle or two of Meursault and give everyone a glass of that.
Right.
And then also at the table alongside you are the winemakers. So you're at a table with
who are there for the grand tasting
winemakers
that day, pouring their wine.
So you know,
dozens
if you're sitting next to
Armand Rousseau's guy.
Well, it's usually Rousseau himself or his daughter
there?
Or Jean-Marc Rouleau or, like the Muneerja Borg sisters or Guillaume d'Angerville. Like, you're in luck because that's what you're drinking all night long.
So it's a very expensive event.
It's
Burgundy. It's a special thing. And it sounds like it's equally special to sommeliers.
I think so. They're... They're also adding events that are a little bit more approachable and easier to afford,
like
which is really exciting.
And cheaper Bordeaux and all that
stuff. Seminars.
The schedule. You know, if you're interested, anybody can go on the La Palais website and find out more. All right, let's talk about Blue Hill for a little bit. It's fair to say the restaurant showcases local food and a wine list with producers who respect artisanal technique. We talked about that a little, but what does that mean in the context of Blue Hill?
I mean, I think it means, you know, both the food and, you know, what you're drinking in your glass are just representative of where they come from. You know, the seasonality of the food here shows that, you know, you're not going to get a tomato at Blue Hill or, you know, in December or, you know, a cucumber in your gin martini, you know, if cucumbers aren't in season, you know, those kinds of things.
Farm to table means what's available.
What's available,
And like you said, you're not going to get a gorgeous summer tomato in the middle of the winter.
Definitely
not.
Just
not going to play with that.
And then as far as the wine list, I mean, it's...
Is it more challenging?
I think a lot of people come in and expect all of the wines to be or local or like a big, heavy, heavy local wine section. And it's
what do you mean,
New York State. I mean, I guess even Canada could be, Ontario could be considered. And there are like a handful, but what I really like to highlight are farmers who are growing indigenous grape varietals in a particular region, you know, kind of bringing the history back through the wine, which is what we're doing with a lot of the food here.
Right.
A lot of food at Blue Hill.
So is it more challenging at a place like that than a traditional restaurant, you know, where there's lamb and fish?
It can be.
It changes more than most places. I mean, most restaurants now are seasonal.
Yeah.
But you're going to get the steak and chops and fish.
Yeah.
What do you pair with asparagus?
I mean,
do you ever get stuck with something?
Right. Yeah, big time. Also because you want diversity in what you're pouring, because we also have a ton of regulars who come in all the time, you know, and lean to me to kind of just pour them something here and there. And I don't want to always have just, Grüner Veltliner with the asparagus, which would be like, you know, the
classic matchup,
because asparagus is so hard. So then you kind of like start branching out and just like, tasting a lot. So I think we did recently like a Petite Arvine with the asparagus, and it worked beautifully.
Now, what is a Petite Arvine? Where is it from? What type of
Valle d'Aosta, northern Italy, very high elevation, kind of herbal mountain white wine. Fresh, full-bodied, but definitely like more herbaceous. So it really paired well with herbaceous type of green things.
Good acidity.
Like asparagus, great
did
acidity.
You say?
Yeah, great acidity.
Now, do you do... I would think I would leave it to you to eat there and do a by the glass or pairing program.
We have a pairing, and it changes as the menu changes.
It's not just the open bottles from the bar. I mean, you decide what you're gonna.
It's never anything. It's generally never anything that's even on the wine list at all. I have like a stash of wines I kind of keep off off to the side, and we'll rotate around them. And sometimes they'll get thrown onto the list if the dish changes. Then I'll order more of something else once I talk to the chef about kind of what's happening the following week.
So it's a good play.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, there's a wine pairing. They're just going to dump wines on me.
It's quite
the opposite at your place.
Yeah.
And probably at any good place.
Yeah.
They're well thought out wines.
They are. And they're fun and interesting and have a story. You know, it's very easy to make someone happy by pouring them, you know, a glass of white Burgundy followed by a glass of old Bordeaux. You know, it's a little bit more difficult when you're doing like Petit Darvin followed by, you know, Savoie White or something like this. But, you know, the staff is educated on the stories of the wine, and I think the wines are delicious and go well with the food. So
take me through a typical meal. is it coursed? Is it a tasting menu?
Yeah. So there's two options. Well, actually, there's three options when you go. So there's a four-course prefix menu.
Right.
So you have three savory and one dessert. And you have options for each course is there. And then there's what we call the Farmer's Feast, which is the set tasting menu of that day, which I think is the best thing to go for.
More courses than four?
It's
or?
Six courses. So you get four savory plus two dessert.
So how many, if you did the glass wine pairing, how many different wines are you tasting?
You're tasting six.
You are.
Because you're going to start off with some bubbles
first. Every course.
Yeah,
dessert wines at the end.
Yeah,
or sweet
something
wine.
Something fun at the end
and
for dessert.
And on the four course, it's four wines?
Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk this past few weeks. The six course wine, what's the split between red and white?
This past week's been two. It's been, we start off with bubbles, kind of for your little snacky bits at the front. And I try not to choose champagne. Tried to choose something a little bit different.
Sparkler, though?
Sparkler, yeah. Like generally
Cremant
a sparkler.
Cremant, or
right now we're using a really great Cava producer that I really love.
Tell us.
Called Alta Alella is the producer.
Alta Alella.
And it's Brut Nature Cava from a very small producer very close to Barcelona. All Chiarello, which is the grape varietal. And it's just beautiful and dry and citrusy, but also kind of smoky and goes great with
nice.
Now we get a lot of like charcuterie and things like that at the beginning of the meal at Blue Hill.
Nice.
So it's nice to have something with a little bit more of like a texture to it.
Nice.
Yeah, it's great. And then generally, yeah, sometimes two white. Right now it's two whites, two reds, and then you get a dessert
Some
wine.
Some kind of dessert mm-hmm. wine. Sounds great. And then if people buy bottles of wine,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if they're wine knowledgeable, they'll drink two, three bottles mm-hmm. in the course of a... I mean, if they're serious, they want to maybe do a sparkle or a white
and then
a red.
Yeah.
That's typical.
Yeah.
And you guide them through all of that.
Yeah.
So Dan practices sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
He's famous for that.
Yes.
Does that carry over to you on how you select wines? We talked about a little
sure.
earlier with the natural wines. I wanted to save it. I mean, you said, God, people think I should have wines from New York or just natural. How does it affect, you know, how you put your list together?
Yeah, I mean, every wine on the list has a story and a reason why it's there. You know, even, you know, I don't know. We have Dom Perignon on the list, too, but that's just because it's delicious. But other than that, you know, most of the wines have a story, and it generally boils down to some sort of sustainable agriculture reason. You know, a lot of the stories are the same, where, you know, the winemaker is planting cover crops in between the vines to, like, aerate the soil. And
so you know the story on most of the wines.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you talk to the customers about it?
If they want. Not
okay.
all of them. Yeah,
right.
I feel it out.
But
and
if people are interested, like, tell
yeah.
me about this wine,
yeah.
or, you know, I want natural wines.
Oh, yeah.
You'll talk about all of that.
I think it's very important at a place like Blue Hill because everyone is there for the experience, and they want the stories about the food, but also the wine. I mean, we're parading giant squash through the dining room.
Right.
So if we're, like, going to have a wine on the wine list, I hope we have a story behind that, too.
Right.
So
That was my point.
Yeah.
There's a big story in the food. The wine shouldn't be, you know, left out with
yeah.
that story. You've designed, or the wine list has been designed
mm-hmm.
a little differently
yes.
than most wine lists. You
yeah.
open up a wine list and it says Italy,
yeah.
France, Rhone, you know, Jura, whatever.
Yeah.
Your wine list is presented how?
It's
interesting.
It's by style.
And you have over a dozen styles.
Yeah.
So explain to me why you do style and what some of the styles
sure.
are.
So I think it's a little bit easier. First of all, the wine list isn't really that large. It's 150 selections, which compared to a lot of the other big restaurants in New York, it's way smaller.
But you rotate.
Yeah, we rotate a lot.
because of the seasonality.
Yeah, like, we rotate a lot.
Okay, but it's very curated, obviously.
Yeah, it's very fun to have it broken up into style like that. So, for example, on the white wine side, there's crisp and bright, there's elegant and round, there's aromatic and floral, petrol and stoned fruit, and then medium and rich. So what it does,
that's different categories.
Yeah, five, right? So
yeah, five.
What that lets me do is group things together. For example, like I can have, you know, a white wine from the Canary Islands or from Corsica, you know, alongside something like a Sancerre, and it doesn't get lost.
Right.
So it's, you know, people just go straight for like Sancerre category for something like light and fresh, which fair enough, it's easy to go to. But there's something like a Corsican Vermentino right above it or right below it. They kind of see that too. They're like, huh, what's that?
Does that make the customer a little more comfortable or focused?
Definitely.
In general. I mean, a lot of wine people who know wine don't need
In general, but. I think it makes the conversation with the guest way easier. You know, especially with reds, because we have like a page of Pinot Noirs, but mixed alongside those are things like Blaufränkisch or, you know, I don't know, maybe a carbonic macerated Listan Negro from Lanzarote or something like this. So these like crazy things that we're going to be on a Canary Islands category,
right.
Like one or two wines,
right.
It would just be overlooked.
Gives you some good leeway.
Gives me leeway and it lets me move the wines a lot more.
Do you ever hear from customers that you don't have enough of the big Bordeaux's or Cali Colts or Burgundies?
Oh, sure.
Because I think that type of restaurant, you may get the type of clientele that's like, you know, I want a 89, Conseiller, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, well, there's something in every category, but generally just like one or two, especially Bordeaux.
Not an issue, really.
Yeah. Barolo, there's like two, you know, Burgundy, there's like one Nuit Saint-Georges, one Chambon Musigny, one Gevrey Chambertin. It's there and it hits all different price points and styles.
Right.
So there's a way to find something for everybody, whether or not you want a big, you know, heavy Napa cab or like a light, easy drinking Beaujolais.
So the wine list is designed by style, not region.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe some of the styles in white. What's the slant? If you look at Italian, French, American, of the 150 plus bottles, how does the slant, you know?
It's mostly French.
It is mostly French?
It's mostly French, yeah.
Within French, it's mostly?
You know, it's pretty varied all over France. Yeah, it really is. At the
why,
moment, especially.
Why is that? It pairs well with the food? Is that your not directive, but your direction?
Yeah, it pairs with the food. It's just, like, French wine is generally pretty clean, you know?
So if you were forced to do Italian, more Italian, it would be harder because there's more French wines, regions, types. It just plugs in better.
It plugs in better, and I probably just taste more French wine. I mean, I just have a natural affinity, generally speaking, more towards French wine. But then I would say Italian plays a close second, U.S. probably third after that, and then kind of a little bit of everything else in between, Greek, Spain, you know.
The stuff people
wherever
want.
Else. Yeah.
We're going to take a break in a few minutes, but not yet. You also have a nice large beer list, too.
Yeah.
You know, more than most restaurants. There's some pretty cool beers there.
Yeah.
Same thing. Take some time to get the diversity in different types and areas.
Definitely. And
why do you have such a big beer list?
We have... So the beer list was kind of a collaboration between myself and the person that was there before me. And then after I came with like one of the other managers that I work alongside. And then we started kind of building these relationships with a lot of local brewers in
there's
the area.
A lot now.
Yeah, there's a lot now. There's a lot of great ones who kind of just, they change what they're doing so often. So it's almost like a CSA of beer. It's like, here's what we have, here's what you get.
Right.
You know, and it's really fun for the staff, I think, to learn different styles. So we represent all different types of styles, but also, again, like breweries with stories.
So go back. If I do the 4 or 6 course dinner, you have the wines by the glass slotted out.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say to you, listen, what am I getting? 6 wines? Can you knock one out and give me a beer?
Totally.
Would you do that?
We would do that. We also actually have on our printed on the menu, it says, please inquire about non-traditional pairings. So we'll also do a whole pairing where it's not just wine. We'll incorporate beer, some sort of cocktail, spirit, maybe sherry, maybe cider. I make sweet vermouth. We put in the sweet vermouth sometimes.
Right. Have a couple of your own brand.
We have all sorts of little things that we'll throw in there and make it fun, you know.
Very
like,
cool.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to subject you to our wine list, ask you a bunch of questions.
Okay.
We're sitting with Michelle Bichelier. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Michelle is the wine director at Blue Hill, which we talked, you know, a little about. Very interesting place. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back after this break.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The bran, or the roughage, makes up about 14% of the whole grain. It's the outer skin of the edible kernel. It contains large amounts of B vitamins, some protein, trace minerals, phytochemicals, but most importantly, dietary fiber. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hey. Like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Michelle Bichelia from Blue Hill in New York City on Washington?
75 Washington Place in between 6th Avenue and McDougal.
And it's a step-down restaurant, mm-hmm. and it used to be a speakeasy?
It did, yeah. It, you know, there's a lot of different stories. There's a lot of neighbors that come and tell us, oh, I remember this. This used to be this or that. It was a place actually called Marta.
Not the Danny Meyer Marta.
No, a different Marta, yeah, a while ago. And then it was also kind of a place where, like, a lot of, like, army pilots used to hang out.
Oh, really?
Out. Yeah, it like just, at a bar, speakeasy. Yeah,
it became a hangout for mm-hmm. And Blue Hill opened in, what, 2000?
Mm-hmm.
It's been around a while.
17 years now.
All right, so we're going to subject Michelle to our wine list and hope to get some good info from her.
Okay.
All right, so question one, what are you drinking now? Not right in front of you, but what are you tasting, trying, new, restaurant, personal, home?
Yeah. Home, we drink a lot of, like, light, fresh whites, actually. Especially, like...
Be specific.
Yeah, so, I mean, Muscadet is something I always have in my refrigerator.
Give me a couple of good producers. Yeah,
Pepierre. Is my favorite. We have Malvasia, dry Malvasia from the Canary Islands.
Malvasia.
Yep.
A red wine?
White wine.
White wine
white
from the
wine
Canary Islands.
From the Canary Islands.
Good value?
Great value.
Is there a producer you could throw at?
Producer I love is Los Bermejos, Bermejos.
And that's a Malvasia from the Canary Islands.
Yep. Great. All stainless steel, so like very fresh, aromatic and floral, very pretty, but crushable.
Those are good ones.
Yeah.
Does it change with you? Like in the winter,
all the
obviously
time.
You'll
it changes
switch.
Like every
right.
week. Yeah.
You're like, you have like a farm to table brain now, you know? All right. Next question. I wish Simone was here. He'll walk in. Give me your favorite wine and food pairing.
Ooh.
Yours.
Okay. That's hard. But my favorite food in the world is just like a very simple spaghetti pomodoro. And Simone, my husband, makes the most incredible like pomodoro sauce in the world. It's just very simple tomato sauce. He like lets it cook for about 8 hours. And
the sauce?
The sauce. Just like,
and it's just a simple tomato.
Very, very simple.
Do we know the ingredients? It's like canned whole tomatoes
it can be
or crushed?
In the winter, yeah, it can
does
be canned whole.
Does he use
whole.
Fresh tomatoes sometimes?
In the summertime, he does. He generally mixes it with part canned, part fresh. But he'll buy like the really good, high-quality canned tomatoes.
Garlic, onion. Italy.
Garlic, no onion.
No onion.
Great olive oil. It's a very good olive oil is an important component. And he just kind of like lets it simmer.
Nice.
Yeah, he sweats out the garlic a little
so
bit.
So what pairs with that?
So what
you could change, but what's the classic?
Yeah, I think what we drink a lot with that are wines from, like, the northern Piedmont, but, like, more simple grapes. Like, Grignolino is one of my...
Is that Alta Piedmont or northern Piedmont?
It's Piedmont. I guess you just call it Piedmont.
Okay.
But, there's two grape varietals that I love from Piedmont that are not Nebbiolo, and they are Grignolino and Freisia.
Are these red or?
They're both red.
So Grignolino, yep. G-R-I.
G-R-I-G-N-O-L-I-N-O, Grignolino.
Grignolino.
Grignolino. Okay. Another one is Freisa, F-R-E-I-S-A,
Freisa.
Freisa. Yeah. And they're great with this pasta
sauce. Good
value
wines?
Both great value wines, yeah. I don't drink anything too high-end or expensive at home.
Except for an occasion or whatever.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So we're looking at a simple spaghetti pomodoro with some northern Piedmont wines, Grignolino and Freisa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very easy to say.
That's a first. You know, Scott Conin kind of became famous with Scarpetta for that simple pomodoro, you know, spaghetti dish. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I don't ask this to people. It's not on the regular list.
Okay.
But we talked about it earlier. Hardest food to pair a wine with. You've got more experience with that than anyone.
I think, very often on the tasting menu at Blue Hill, actually at the moment, is this, where we do, two vegetable fish, something like that, and then we'll do a meat course, and then we finish with vegetable. Like, right now it's with parsnip steak. Which is a parsnip that's treated like a steak.
They do that with cauliflower.
It's like you're doing this.
So it's a dense vegetable grilled or.
Yeah. And it comes, or it's very difficult. But, depending on kind of how it's cooked, right now it's lightly pickled before it's kind of grilled. So we're actually pairing it with Lopez de Heredia red wine. So Rioja red wine, but it's almost like sweet and sour red wine. So it goes actually really well with the parsnip. And it's also about, the progression of the wines on the pairing, too. You know,
that's
you're
going
to go back to, something different. So, yeah, it's fun. That's the hardest thing for me to do is follow that.
Simone, we asked Michelle her favorite wine and food pairing, and she said your Pomodoro and a Nebbiolo wine.
Grignolino.
Not a Nebbiolo, Grignolino. My bad. Do you have a favorite wine and food pairing besides that?
I would say that I probably like to pair the margherita pizza slice.
Right, with
a glass of Fiano di Avellino.
Ooh.
Which is Sicilian?
No, that's Campania.
That's Campania.
But volcanic area, yeah.
So pizza, here, move up closer.
Pizza and Fiano.
Yeah. Fiano.
You can't go wrong.
Michelle, give me a good Fiano. It's a fairly reasonable wine,
fairly
right?
reasonable wine. The one that we drink the most at home right now is called Guido Marcella, Marsella. Is the producer, and it is a delicious, soulful, smoky white wine.
Great.
Yeah.
Simone knows because he's a famous chef, so that's why I asked him, all right? All right, Michelle, your favorite wine restaurant and or bar, obviously besides Blue Hill, where the slant towards the wine selection and service is impressive to you.
Yeah, I mean, as far as, wine bar with food, we go to Compagnie Servin Naturel quite a bit.
Caleb.
Yeah.
I call him Caleb, but it's Caleb. He comes up a lot.
Yeah.
Give me another one.
Another one. Good food, good wine, funky, nice. I mean,
have you ever done a mixtape there?
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't.
Yeah. I guess you're on the
maybe
on deck somewhere.
On the deck list. Yeah. Pasquale Jones. We love going there.
Great.
I mean, I love pizza. I
great
can eat pizza,
pizza
every day.
You know, Robert and all that.
And Charlie Burr.
Yeah.
Charlie Burr.
Yeah.
So you guys are in heaven.
Yeah.
Tell me your favorite all-time wine. What's the wine?
I mean,
this day just resonates. It was either life-changing, birthday.
Well, the wine that got me into wine, the wine that made me change my whole direction of my life was a 1966 Burgundy from Domaine Leroy, producer, and it was Pommard Epinot. 1966.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was this something you tasted at Pastis?
Yeah.
It was.
Exactly. Yeah.
Amazing.
And that's the one that made me say, I want to go to this part of the world and find out why this happens.
Great.
So it's a wine I'll never forget.
That's a good one. I don't think anyone on the show has knocked a 66 on this list.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Tap into your expertise. And we sort of broached this a little.
Mm-hmm.
Best wine around $15 retail. I want a red and a white. My oldest son's 27. He's going to dinner with six other friends. He's bringing three bottles of wine. He wants to impress, but he ain't spending a lot of money.
Okay.
What red is he going to buy in that around that price range?
Red, let's see. I mean, probably Beaujolais, I would say. Beaujolais? Beaujolais, yeah.
That's Gamay.
I mean, $15
15
retail.
15 to 20?
You'd probably have to go with a kind of very unknown producer, perhaps.
Not crappy, just unknown.
But okay. You could also do, actually, Marcel Lapierre does his Raisin Galois, it's called, and it's Gamay. It's like non-Appalachian Beaujolais, but it's delicious.
That's
light,
good,
easy, and fresh.
Good call on that.
And then white, there's a Vino Verde from Portugal that I think is really good, and it's from a producer called Asnella. A-S-N-E-L-L-A.
Now, would you rank that above a Muscadet or
similar?
So that Muscadet is always the right answer for a white at 15. That's quality, but
yeah. But this particular Vino Verde is maybe even like $13.
Okay, so yeah. Vino Verde from Asnella,
yeah, okay. In Portugal.
So that's a good one.
Yeah.
All right, you did a yeoman's job on our wine list, but more importantly, you gave us a lot of great recommendations, which is really why I do it.
Good.
All right, our last segment in the show is our weekly wine sip. That's
okay.
When we taste wine. So every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we are going to taste, because it's hot out and it's summer, a 2015 La Spinetta Toscana Vermentino by Giorgio Rivetti from Casanova della Spinetta.
Yeah.
This wine is from the Tuscan region, and I'm going to ask you in a second. Most Vermentinos are not Tuscan, so this is a little different.
Right.
It's 100% Vermentino grape, this particular one. This wine retails for about $14 to $20, and it's fairly readily available at, you know, better wine stores. All right, so what more can you tell me about Vermentino?
Yeah.
And can you tell me anything specifically? And I'm going to ask Simone to pour.
So Vermentino is also a wine that I always have in my refrigerator. I actually really love the grape varietal. I think it's pretty undervalued and underrepresented very often. I love it from Corsica, from Liguria in northern Italy. You see it a little bit from Tuscany sometimes. Generally, it's a little bit more oaked in Tuscany, if you do find it. But it's soft. It's very floral, almost melony. In kind of like taste profile, but generally very clean, pure, and dry.
So, Corsica, Liguria, where else did you say?
I just said those two. Tuscan.
Okay, so that's France and Italy.
Yeah.
But Corsica is like right above the
Sardinia.
Right.
Yeah.
Aren't the grapes called something different in other regions?
Well, this one is not. This one in Corsica is called Vermentino.
Okay.
So it's only one letter off.
Okay.
And then in northern Italy, it's still Vermentino.
And Rivetti and La Spinetta is basically a Tuscan or a Barolo?
Giorgio Rivetti. So he's actually located in the Asti region.
Okay.
Is where La Spinetta, the winery, is, which is very close to Barolo.
Okay.
It's not too far from Barolo or Barbaresco. It's closer to Barbaresco. And they make a lot of different wines from the Asti region, also from Tuscany. They're very well known for their Moscato d'Asti, but they also make really great white and red vermouth as well. They make a lot of different wines. You go there, I've been there.
Pretty diverse.
I've been there. I've tasted it. I think
is it considered a good, better quality winemaker?
It is.
I mean,
yeah,
he's making a lot of stuff, but it's good.
It's good. Yeah, okay. he sources. You know, he's smart about where he sources from, and he's meticulous with detail. So I think it's translated in the wine.
All right, so we're gonna taste it first. Let's look at the color.
Yeah.
So it's kind of
it's very pale, light straw color, I would say.
Pale straw, but there's definitely a yellow to it.
Yep.
But it's pale.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the nose.
Yeah, so it smells great. It smells almost like cantaloupe, melon, honeydew, a touch of almost salinity on the nose.
Some
you can smell,
I guess,
smell the
Tuscan,
sea.
Tuscan, the coast, or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's got a nice nose. I get a little apple in there.
Yeah, it's very pretty, floral. Like honeysuckle a little bit too.
All right, let's throw it over the tongue, and you got a head start. Let's give it a taste. So let's start with mouthfeel.
Yeah.
Medium, light.
Medium.
Medium.
Yeah, it's not really light, huh? It's
good mouthfeel.
Good mouthfeel, good texture.
You feel some acidity.
Mouth. Yeah.
So it's mouth coating, medium.
Mouth coating, medium bodied. On the palate, the taste is similar to what it smelled like. It's pretty. It's got apple notes. It's floral. Touch of that honeysuckle on the finish, but dry.
Lots
acid
of fruit.
Is high. Yeah, it's fruity, but acid, it hits you at the end, so it's good.
Any,
balanced.
Do you pick up any minerality or?
Yeah, a little bit. It's kind of salty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On the.
Yeah.
A little of the aftertaste.
Yeah.
There's a little salt on the tongue.
Yeah.
Balanced?
Balanced, yeah. I would say this is, what, $14 retail? It's great.
I'd say probably 14 is the low end, 15,
yeah.
16 bucks.
Yeah.
So it's a good summer quaffer.
I'd say.
Now let's talk about what do we pair with this?
Yeah. I mean, right now, this I think Vermentino is a great varietal for a lot of these spring vegetables that are kind of out.
Ramps
so,
and
ramps,
green
peas,
onions.
Exactly.
Peas.
Spring onions. Fiddlehead ferns, all the different greens that you see in the market right now. Yeah, this is like a great.
So a Vermentino goes great with all those spring vegetables.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that one of the top choices, or it's a good choice? I mean, I wouldn't do a red with those, right?
No, I wouldn't.
Right.
I wouldn't. No. I think Vermentino is a great choice for that, yeah.
Okay. Do we like this wine?
I do like it, yeah.
Is it a good wine for the price?
I think so. I think price point, yeah, value, it's good.
It's made well and...
Yeah.
Okay.
It's clean. It tastes like Vermentino, which is what you want.
Right.
It's definitely Italian. You know, you can, like, taste the Italian in it.
Can you distinguish a Tuscan Vermentino from a Ligurian or a Corsican?
Oh, yeah.
Would you be able to tell me a trait different from this?
Corsican this is definitely richer than this is richer than a Corsican or a Ligurian one would be. Corsican one for me is always way more floral and a little bit more like softer, but it really has that kind of piercing melony thing, where this is a little bit richer, more appley, more round. It's got more weight, more body, more texture. And then Liguria is like salt bomb.
It is.
It's so, yeah, because it's grown, like if you can picture Cinque Terre in your mind, it's grown like on those cliffs, sea spraying on the grapevines. Yeah.
So the question isn't really what's the best region. It's what do you like and what are you eating and,
exactly.
You know, what pairs.
Yeah.
That Ligurian may pair better with something,
mm-hmm.
or some people may have more of a taste than a richer wine.
Yeah.
So Vermentino, you could look at those three areas. I brought the Tuscan one in just because I knew it was a bit of an outlier. I was curious.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the 2015 La Spinetta Toscana Vermentino. It's made by Giorgio Rovetti from Casanova della Spinetta. It's 14 to 20 bucks. Michelle liked it.
I did.
Pairs well with
a
lot of wines.
It.
I saw Simone smiling a bit, so I think he liked it. But I'd be challenged that if I gave him anything, he'd smile. But that's just me. All right. I wanted to talk about one last thing before we wrap up the show. When we were talking about Blue Hill, Dan Barber is definitely a leader in the community of sustainable food and farm-to-table and all that. The reason I'm bringing it up is because a very cool event just ended, and it happened in the States a year or two ago.
2 years
and you
ago.
Just did it in London.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Wasted.
Mm-hmm.
It's W-A-S-T.
Capital E, capital
ED.
D, as
so
in waste education.
Wasted food, all the food that you throw away or, you know, what you don't think you would use. And there's a lot of food that's thrown away. So Dan put this sort of, it's more of a cause and a program together.
Yeah,
talk about it for a second.
Sure. So when we did it in New York City, we totally changed the restaurants. We closed down Blue Hill, New York, reopened as Wasted, and the entire restaurant was made from things that were wasted. So, for example, the tables were grown from, like, mushroom spores into a table. You know, hanging on the walls of the restaurant for decor was remade, which is what you...
So you really transformed.
The entire thing, yeah.
It wasn't just the food. It was...
It was
you're
everything.
Sitting on a table that was reconstituted.
Exactly, yeah.
Cool.
And then the menu was, you know, full of ingredients that normally would have been tossed out. So, for example, we partnered with a lot of
the tops of carrots or whatever.
Tops of carrots, ugly vegetables. But, you know, if you go to... I don't know, Russin Daughters and get a smoked salmon, they kind of like just fillet it, and there's this whole piece in the middle that, yes, the bloodline is there, but there's still meat attached to the sides there. And they would just toss it because they're doing it quick
fish
and getting
heads,
rid of it.
Tails,
so we did that with Acme Smoked Fish Company.
In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, we partnered with Baldor, who does... Biggest produce guys, but they also do a, like, already prepared, like, already cleaned vegetable side thing, too. And when they're cleaning the vegetables, you know, they're just, like, chopping off the top and the bottom of a carrot or peeling them or pre-peeling them and tossing the peelings. They had tons, I mean, literally... tons and tons of vegetable waste.
So Dan's task was to show the world that with all this throwaway wasted stuff, that he would construct these delicious meals.
Yeah, but we also had we named them funny things. So like the salad was called the Dumpster Dive Salad because it's literally things that Valder would throw in the dumpster. We had an item on the menu that was called dog food because it's all like the offcuts of meat that would normally go into dog food.
Right.
You know, so you're like in the kitchen, you're like, did the chef just like fire one dog food? You know. But they did. But the one thing that we did that we still actually have on the menu today is the juice pulp vegetable burger. So we were using...
What is that?
So it's a veggie burger made with leftover kind of like pressings from when you're making juice. So being in the West Village, there's like eight juice juice places.
So the texture, it's all vegetable
it's
and
all
the texture's
vegetable.
There.
Yeah,
it's
texture's
just
there.
It's throwaway pulp and all of that.
Yeah, but
so
you know...
So it's seasoned and other
it's
added.
Delicious. It's delicious. So we have that on our current bar menu now, which we're calling our fast food menu, which is kind of a throwback to wasted.
So this happened in London. It was staged as a pop-up somewhere?
It was a pop-up on the rooftop of Selfridges, which is a department store. But
Very high profile.
Very high profile. And it was 7 weeks long. And again, every night they had a guest chef, you know, from Europe.
And the type of thing that sells out. I mean, people are coming from all over.
It sold out immediately.
Can we anticipate something coming back here in the future? I mean, not... corner
maybe.
You to something.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm sure it'll happen.
Yeah, maybe not the same exact concept, but perhaps something a little bit different.
All right. So that's sort of a admirable thing and a very inventive and creative thing.
Yeah.
The awareness part is huge.
It, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you could just move people a little.
Yeah. The thing is, it's not really that new, right? Like,
right.
Like in most cultures, they do it already.
Right.
It's
We're the worst.
Or in cooks. It's in
that's why City Harvest goes around and picks up truckloads of, you know, used food and old food and all that. All right. I want to thank Michelle Bisceglia from Blue Hill for joining us. If you have a question, a wine happening or an event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. You could follow The Grape Nation on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We will post Michelle's wine list answers probably by Friday. So if things sounded good, they'll be laid out specifically for you. We are on Instagram at SBenRuby, and we're on Twitter at JustBenRuby. And you can listen to this and all the Grape Nation shows on iTunes, Stitcher, and you can go to the Heritage Radio Network website. Michelle, where can we follow you? You are on Instagram?
I have a Twitter account. I don't really use it, but okay. I have the same handle for both Twitter and Instagram. It's Mish Bisc. So that's MICHBISC. As in Michelle.
Okay.
Michelle.
So you could follow Michelle. Today she was out having DeFara's Pizza, which is considered the greatest pizza in the world. And Dom, the guy who makes the pizza, was there.
He was there.
They took their little Vespa or whatever they're riding around in there.
I have a Vespa.
And I think Simone picked up a goat or a donkey or whatever at some meat store. That's okay. That's what they're going to have for dinner tonight. And what about Blue Hill? Website or?
Blue Hill is www.bluehillfarm.com. And on Instagram and Twitter as well, it's at Blue Hill Farm.
And we talked about the wine list. You can go online, see the wine list,
it's on
the way
the
Michelle
website.
Lays it out by style and the descriptions and all that, and the type of wines. And you know what? When you go on a wine, when you go on a site like that, look at the wine list. There's a lot of inspiration there. Because don't forget, when you look at the prices, those are restaurant prices. If you can imagine finding those wines retail, and not all of them are available.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're less. And, you know, there's some great wines. But we also talked about, you know, some other wines. So I want to thank you, Michelle. for coming in, and I want to thank our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.